Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's been 10 weeks since Sony announced it had been hacked. Today, co-chairman Amy Pascal took the fall. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 5th of February today. And the question that has been asked so many times since the Sony hack was disclosed, that is, how long can Amy Pascal hang on, has now been answered. Pascal will be leaving her job as co-chairman of Sony Pictures Entertainment. It is perhaps the last, but also the biggest impact of North Korea's, shall we say, displeasure with Sony's movie, The Interview. Tatiana Siegel is senior film writer for The Hollywood Reporter. Tatiana, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
I suppose there's an issue of characterization we have to address here. Amy Pascal is stepping down. She is not being asked to leave.
Well, no one is ever officially fired in Hollywood, but right. I think it's safe to say nobody also leaves a job that pays $15 million a year for no good reason.
What was, in your mind, the underlying reason? Was it the hack itself? Was it that she greenlit the movie that got them hacked? Was it the emails about black movies and President Obama? Or was it just the whole smash?
I think that her fate was sealed the day that President Obama went on the TV and said that North Korea was behind the hack, because that was the day that it became clear, at least in the U.S. government's eyes, that that movie, The Interview, caused this hack, which will cause millions of dollars in damages. So once North Korea was fingered as the perpetrator, Amy Pascal has to take the blame because she's the one who agreed to make this movie.
But it has to be said, the last couple of years have not been that great for Sony, right? I mean, 2013 was terrible. You could call it lousy. Yeah. Was she kind of on thin ice anyway?
I mean, definitely anybody who endures the 2013 that she endured with After Earth and...
Whatever that was. I don't even remember that one.
Yes, and White House Down. I think that, you know, she was on thin ice, but, you know, it's a cyclical business and you just need one great year. I mean, she was consistently over time a very successful studio executive and studio head.
She was, it is fair to say, one of the most powerful women in Hollywood, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, then here's the thing I don't understand. She was on a par with Michael Linton at Sony Pictures Entertainment. You know, one was chairman, one was CEO or whatever it was. They shared power. She now is stepping down and he somehow gets to stay. How do they square that?
You know, that's going to be the thing that possibly sparks some backlash, because why does she take the blame in the fall and he kind of gets to continue on? But I think it goes back to North Korea being blamed for this. If this were a hack that was perpetrated by a disgruntled former employee, as some people thought and still think, then Michael may have taken the blame because, you know, Amy Pascal probably didn't even know who was the head of the IT department. This was not her domain, you know, security. But the fact that it was North Korea, it's like she decided to make that movie, and that's what, you know, ultimately is her downfall.
Just by way of epilogue here, she will keep on making movies, right? Her stepping down deal gives her a production agreement where she's going to make the Ghostbusters sequel and something Spider-Man, right?
Absolutely. She will continue to make great movies just as a producer, as opposed to an executive who gets to say yes to the movies. Right. You know, it's a little bit of a different power dynamic, but she will not be hurting.
Tatiana Siegel is a senior film writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Tatiana, thanks very much for your time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
This is just a hacking kind of day, I guess. Anthem, the biggest health insurer in this country, revealed today that hackers have gotten their hands on the personal data of tens of millions of current and former customers. Things like social security numbers and email addresses, birth dates, as well as data on Anthem employees themselves. This is, as you know, the latest in a long, long string of hacks the past couple of years. Data that for us is perhaps priceless, but for the hackers is worth how much, do you suppose? Marketplace's Adam Allington has the price list.
Unlike previous high-profile hacks, the Anthem Blue Cross hackers did not take credit card numbers, but personal data like your social security number can be even more valuable on the so-called dark web, the invisible part of the internet you can't find on Google.
Where data is bought and sold in real time, and it's subject to all the laws of economics like supply and demand.
John Kindervag is a security analyst at Forrester Research. He says credit card and social security numbers are the most easily monetizable.
Now, sometimes we see where there haven't been very many credit card attacks happening, the price of a credit card rises. If there's a big breach, the price of a stolen credit card falls.
Kindervag says credit card numbers only work for a short period of time, so are typically less valuable than a social security number, which can be used now or a year from now.
You know, credit card numbers can attract cents or a dollar. Identities can attract scores of dollars or even hundreds of dollars.
Trent Telford is the CEO of the data security firm Covada. He says Anthem was vulnerable and didn't invest in even basic data security protocols.
You know, investing in protecting and encrypting or securing your customers' records costs money, and it's not as fancy or flash as a Super Bowl ad, right?
And unlike a credit card, which can be easily replaced by a bank, Telford says Anthem won't be the one to sort out your credit rating or file a police report if your identity is stolen. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Twitter reported profits after the bell this afternoon, made just a bit more money than everybody had been guessing, but the growth rate of its user base slowed quite a bit, which perhaps helps explain a story we saw on Bloomberg today. Twitter has made a deal with Google that will make it easier for tweets to show up in Google's search results. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on that.
Let's say I type Google Twitter deal into Google, as I did today, just to be meta about it. In the near future, I might see real-time tweets on the topic, along with the collection of news stories and other links that now pop up. For Twitter, that means more people visiting its pages, and the company hopes maybe even signing up.
Twitter is looking for ways to drive user growth.
Analyst Brian Weiser with Pivotal Research says that growth has been sluggish and investors are getting impatient. Twitter wants to extend the reach of its tweets, he says, and
create the conditions for enhanced monetization in the future.
To you and me, that means selling those new Twitter users to advertisers. As for Google, Weiser says,
they want data, first and foremost.
And Twitter's 288 million active users around the world generate a lot of data. Yahoo and Microsoft's Bing already have direct access to all that content. Danny Sullivan is founding editor of the news site Search Engine Land. He says tweets still show up in Google searches, even after its deal with Twitter fell apart in 2011. But without a new deal, Google just can't keep up.
Without that access to the fire hose directly, it's literally like Google's trying to lean in on the side and take a drink, and you just can't do it.
So how about Google users? What's in it for you? Sullivan says Twitter is especially good on breaking news. The traditional sources Google relies on may be several minutes behind. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, 1% to the upside seemed to be the unanimous verdict among the indices. As if they get to decide, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The city of Boston is on nonstop snow removal duty after the pounding it has taken the past couple of weeks. Side streets are still blocked. Some intersections are still clogged, and so traffic is a mess. I checked the weather just before I came into the studio, and it seems there is yet more snow a-coming. So, since they can't make the snow stop, the city is trying to make it disappear. From WBUR in Boston, Shannon Dooling reports.
Standing amidst 20-foot-high snow piles and plenty of heavy machinery, it's as though interim Boston Public Works Commissioner Michael Dennehy were conducting a symphony.
He's going to move. Block the gate? Yeah, we're going to block the gate. Yeah, it's going to flow out. It's going to win a catch basin.
Instead of directing percussion and string sections, he's orchestrating front-end loaders and a supercat dozer at the city's largest snow farm. After a week of record snowfall, Boston is still digging out from more than 40 inches of snow. The question now, where do you put it all?
It's a big parcel. It's where we're housing most of our snow that we're farming out. But it's actually gotten a little small on us, so what we're doing now is we're trying to increase our capacity by melting some of the snow and giving us the opportunity to remove even more than the 7,500 loads we've taken off the Boston streets already.
And there are certainly plenty more loads of snow waiting on those Boston streets, Dennehy says Public Works will focus on clearing main arteries and major intersections. In a press conference this week, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh said he wouldn't be surprised if the city shattered its snow removal budget.
Our budget for snow is roughly $18 million. We're not over the top yet with the $18 million. We still have money underneath the cap, but we're heading towards that.
The city estimates a $10 million chunk of that budget was swallowed up by a single storm, last week's blizzard, which dumped more than 2 feet of snow on Boston. Dennehy, the interim public works commissioner, seems to have a realistic take on the city's cleanup progress.
When you have to bring a snow melter into your snow farm to continue farming, which is what we need to do, then there's always more work to be done.
Luckily for the city and that soon-to-be-shattered snow removal budget, the snow melters come free of charge, courtesy of the state's Massachusetts Port Authority. In Boston, I'm Shannon Dooling for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If I told to a Dutch person he should go outside and water his lawn with his drinking water, he would look at you like you were crazy.
Yeah, that's nuts. Oh, wait. Wait a minute. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 211 points today, 1 2/3%, closed at 17,884. The NASDAQ added 48 points, that is 1%, 4765. The S&P 500 put on 21 points, 1%, closed at 2,062. Oil got a little pricier today. So too did energy shares. ConocoPhillips logged a 2.5% gain. Exxon ticked up about 1%. On the deal front, pharma giant Pfizer said it would buy fellow pharma giant Hesperia for a giant $15 billion. Hesperia's shares soared 35%. Pfizer closed nearly 3% higher today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.81%. And you? Yeah, you? You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, President Barack Obama will travel to Indiana to discuss middle-class economics. The Labor Department reports on unemployment for the month of January. And on this day in 1937, John Steinbeck's novel Of Mice and Men is published. You probably remember reading this book back in grade school. That's if you did your homework. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The new Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, has been making the grand tour of European capitals this week, trying to persuade his host to let Greece renegotiate the terms of its multi-billion dollar bailout and thus cut its debt. Mr. Varoufakis met with his German counterpart in Berlin today, and to say it did not go well would be by a far stretch. Too gentle. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This was never going to be a meeting of minds. The German finance minister has scorned the new Greek government's anti-austerity. He scoffed at the plan to rehire hundreds of public sector workers, raise pensions, halt the sale of state assets, and restructure Greece's public debt. At today's news conference, though, he said he and his Greek counterpart had agreed to disagree. But Varoufakis disagreed.
We didn't reach an agreement. It was never on the cards that we would. We didn't even agree to disagree from where I'm standing.
And he went on to detail what they had not discussed.
We didn't discuss Greece's debt schedule. We didn't discuss a haircut.
What we did, he said, was set the scene for deliberations to end the crisis. But keen observers do not detect any German readiness to let Greece off the hook. Tom Stevenson of Fidelity Investments.
The mood music out of Germany at the moment is that they're in no mood at all to give concessions to Greece.
Varoufakis had even less success sweet-talking the head of the European Central Bank. After that meeting in Frankfurt yesterday, the ECB announced it was cutting off cheap funding to Greece's commercial banks. Analyst Carsten Nickel says Varoufakis cannot expect any favours from Europe's independent central bank.
The German position, you know, to hold its line vis-à-vis Greece seems to be very much aligned with the position of the European Central Bank, which only makes it more difficult for the new government in Athens.
Varoufakis must have felt relieved today to get home from his European tour, but perhaps not. The Greek newspapers were full of stories about the new government running out of cash as early as next month. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, announced today that it is going to help relieve some of the debt burdens carried by some of the world's poorest countries when those countries suffer serious economic setbacks. And they are going to start, the IMF is, with the three West African countries hit hardest by Ebola. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
To say Liberia was economically hit by Ebola would be a huge understatement.
Basically, everything stopped.
Stephen Radlett teaches global human development at Georgetown and advises Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf.
Fruit markets and food stalls were gone. No one was touching each other. Hotels were empty. The iron ore mines shut down. The palm oil plantations stopped.
Liberia, according to its Ministry of Finance, lost 25% of its annual revenue receipts because of Ebola. At the same time, it owes about $130 million to the IMF. Neighboring Guinea, also dealing with Ebola and also indebted, was spending more on debt relief than on public health. What the IMF has done is offer about $100 million towards such debts, freeing up money to go elsewhere.
It comes along with very specific rules that the money be used to develop social infrastructure, building hospitals and building schools.
Eric LeCompte is with Jubilee USA, which advocates for international debt relief. The IMF also expanded a system that offers debt assistance to poor countries for certain emergencies, like a hurricane or an earthquake.
Essentially, it's creating a global social safety net for the world's poorest countries.
Tony Addison is an economist at United Nations University. He says this kind of relief has long-term impacts.
Well, in the longer term, it enables countries to improve their credit rating.
But he says it doesn't prevent a country from spending itself into debt all over again in the future. And that, he adds, isn't just a poor country problem. Just look at Greece. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We're talking about water this week, about how mostly we just take it for granted, how we use it like it's free and like there's an endless supply. Case in point, you. Do you have any idea how much water you use in a day? And do you know how much it costs? Yeah, no, me neither. And not knowing matters because it affects how much we use, arguably misuse, the most critical natural resource we have. So for today's installment of our series, it's called Water, the High Price of Cheap. We asked Scott Tong from our sustainability desk to track his water footprint.
Let's imagine. Imagine a ticker or a counter that tallies all my water use. Each cup of coffee, every shower, every toilet that's, whoops, found to be running in the kids' bathroom.
So we had this, like, all day?
No, since 4:30.
So, like, 2 hours of this?
Well,
one hour.
An hour and a half.
I'm going to count. That is, I'm going to check the water meter regularly for 24 hours. I have no idea what our family use is going to be. I mean, what's even a reasonable guess?
150 gallons.
200.
This is the parents at the bus stop putting in their bets.
Okay.
120.
110. And I had that number before I heard them.
All right. 50 friends on Facebook and Twitter also weighed in. The median guess was 225 gallons a day. In case you're wondering, the low is 30 and the high is 5,000. Now, first some context. The bare minimum for a person to drink and bathe and clean is 13 gallons a day. That's under an estimate the UN uses. My family of five lives in Arlington, Virginia, in an old brick house.
Bye.
And by the time everyone is off to school and work, we've had one bath, one shower, two shampoos, an overnight load of the dishwasher, and about eight flushes.
All right, I'm going out to read the water meter. It says 60 gallons of water.
Based on the rate my county charges, 60 gallons costs a quarter of a dollar. Yeah, if that sounds like a ridiculous bargain, Stanford hydrologist Nusha Ajami says among the rich countries,
U.S. and U.S. people pay the least. Compare that to Germany, Denmark, France, United Kingdom. They all pay a lot more for the water.
She argues that what comes out of American faucets is underpriced. Many parts of the country have shortages, but scarcity is not baked into the price, as it is with, say, strawberries or diamonds or Picassos. My bill charges me just for water treatment and water delivery. The actual H2O costs zero. And typically, what we pay does not even cover the full cost of sending water and replacing old pipes. Ajami says most of our utilities invest and lose money.
We make $3.50 of investment. We only get $1 back.
Underpricing may explain why I'm now tossing in the first of two loads of laundry. Loads that are semi-full, semi-dirty, and wow, that jacks the running water tap to 200 gallons. A single load in our legacy washer drinks 40 gallons. The next thing, my 9-minute shower, uses 18 gallons, which is a good time to ask, how clean is my water anyway?
It's quite stunning, the quality of the water that we have today.
Duke Law Professor Jim Salzman is author of Drinking Water, A History.
100 years ago, it was commonplace to die of typhoid and cholera. Wilbur Wright, the famed aviation brother, he died of typhoid. It's said that Rommel lost more troops to dysentery than they did to the Allies.
He says the road to today's drinking water goes back at least to 1854 and a London cholera mystery. 500 people died in 10 days. People then figured they got sick from dirty air. And then a doctor named John Snow mapped the victims' homes. And it turns out all of them use the same water well pump.
Snow goes to the Board of Health. The pump is closed. Epidemic ends. It's the first example, really, of public health at that level.
Thus begat the Great Sanitation Awakening. It eventually brought us sewer systems and then the biggie, chlorination. Consider, in 1900 America, your chance of dying from waterborne disease was 1 in 200. It's now 1 in 2 million. Talk about value. Which poses the question, how much of this highly drinkable water gets used for non-drinking reasons? It's not just flushing our toilets. It's the recreational water. By late afternoon, the kids are home, and a trio of sixth-grade girls is bouncing on the trampoline. Now, in the summer, it turns into a slip-and-slide trampoline.
So we put the sprinkler underneath, and then we turn the hose on. We do handstands and everything and jump through the water. It's really fun.
Putting drinking quality water through a garden hose. Now, that flunks the laugh test in much of the world. Economist David Zetlin is author of Living with Water Scarcity. He's Californian, but he teaches in the Netherlands.
If I told to a Dutch person he should go outside and water his lawn with his drinking water, he would look at you like you were crazy because it's money, and Dutch people don't like spending money. If they do have gardens, usually those gardens are rain-fed.
Americans, on a per-person basis, use 60% more water than the Japanese, more than double the French, and 5 times the Danes and the Chinese. Sure, there are culture differences, but to Zetlin, it's mainly economics. And underpriced anything gets overused, even when you compare within the U.S.
The places where water is cheap, and the one, of course, I always bring up is Las Vegas, has a much higher water use than a place like San Francisco, where the price of water is 2 or 3 times the price of water in Las Vegas. And that relationship will hold almost anywhere you go in the world.
Here's another way to think about overuse. We pay for water way after we use it, in my case, quarterly. Imagine feasting at a buffet and swiping your credit card 3 months later. That's in contrast to, say, the ice cream shop we visit after dinner. We order and then we pay. It is the law.
One small with the hot fudge and then another small. That'll be $17.95.
And that timing is crucial to behavioral economist Dan Ariely at Duke. He says there's something called the pain of paying. If you pay as you eat, he says you tend to eat less. And to test this, Ariely brings pizza to class once a year.
And I charge the students 25 cents per bite. And you know what? They eat such big bites that they suffer from the whole thing. Because you sit there with the pizza and you say, if I could only push a little bit more in, I will get more value for your money. But you are really decreasing your joy.
By contrast, what happens if you pay at the end? He tested that.
And people consumed 5 times more. So this idea about timing of payment, when do you do it, is incredibly important.
Okay, so at 9:30 p.m., one last check of the water meter.
Okay, here we go. 250-580, 580 minus 270 is 310 gallons. That's it, 310?
One family, 310 gallons. That's pretty good for 5 Americans, but it's a ton of water. It's actually 1.15 tons to be precise. And that 1 ton for 1 day costs $1.30, about the price of 1 bottle of water. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I had 500 gallons, by the way, in that pool. Shows what I know. You are wondering right now, though, about how much water you use compared to the average household, aren't you? Well, go ahead. Check out our water calculator. It is at marketplace.org. Final notes on the way out today. First of all, as we told you a day or two ago would happen, Radio Shack filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection today. Going out of business, they are. No word on that rumored deal to have Sprint buy half of Radio Shack's retail stores and rebrand them as Sprint outlets. Also, this week's sign, the apocalypse may well be upon us. You know how we cover Fashion Week pretty much every year, the latest and greatest in women's fashion from the runways of New York, or at least the business slice of it? Well, turnabout being fair play, today the Council of Fashion Designers of America announced the first Fashion Week for men. It'll be in New York City mid-July, or as one of our producers put it this morning, a bunch of dudes not wearing socks, showing their ankles.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
All right, that's it. We got to go. Today in the Dow up 211 points, about 1.2%. The NASDAQ gained 48 points. That is 1%. The S&P 500 put on 21 points. That is 1% as well. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.